are a people perpetually under siege. They are marked for expulsion. They are marked for removal from one end of Palestine to the next.
In this week's COVID Race and Democracy, global support keeps growing for the Palestinian cause amidst escalating Israeli attacks.
This is not a conflict. This is an oppressive, genocidal apartheid regime that is committing ethnic cleansing and violent colonization that's ongoing. And we really need to wake up in this country because the rest of the world already gets it and we are just asleep at the wheel right here.
We'll hear voices of solidarity with Palestine on the week of the 73rd anniversary of Nakba, when over 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their land.
It's not accidental. There is a strong targeting by the Israel lobby groups because they have failed to cover up for Israeli colonialism, racism, and apartheid.
Critics of Israel in the United States and the United Kingdom denounce being censored by big tech platforms.
You are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
From 1948 to 1953, the period of greatest immigration, the economic importance to Israel of seized Arab property was decisive.
And we hear about the hidden history of Zionism. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers of the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer.
I recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
In the midst of uncertainty and turmoil, America's support for Israel's security must be rock solid.
Early on when I was a kid, I'd say, when I was a young senator, I'd say, if I were a Jew, I'd be a Zionist. I am a Zionist. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist.
Euer narrische Zionisten, mit euer narrischen Seichel, ihr mögt doch gehen zu dem Arbeiter und lernen bei ihm ein Seichel. Ihr mögt doch gehen zu dem Arbeiter und lernen bei ihm ein Seichel.
Israel has been emboldened by ex-President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as its capital, and allies in the region have fallen in line. Settlement expansion has ramped up, but Palestinian resistance to colonialization and displacement hasn't stopped. To understand the so-called Israel-Palestine conflict, we must first understand the colonial imperialist settlement project behind Zionism. Ralph Shulman is the author of The Hidden History of Zionism.
There have been four prevalent myths that have characterized our understanding of the nature of Zionism and of the Israeli state that is based upon it, and particularly in the United States and in Western Europe. The first myth pertains to the claim of a land without a people for a people without a land. The second myth is that of Israeli democracy. Virtually every newspaper and every television story and every reference to the Israeli state is prefaced by the claim that it is the only real democracy in the Middle East and so on. The third myth pertains to security as the motive force of Israeli foreign policy. Here you have a predatory colonial settler operation which has sought to destabilize each Arab nation in the region and to entrap it and ensnare it in conflict, the better to usurp more territory, presenting itself in a defensive posture. And perhaps the fourth and most prevalent myth has been that of Zionism as the moral legatee of the victims of the Holocaust. And what is particularly savage in the irony that surrounds this claim is the fact that the Zionist movement and the Zionist leaders itself were the active collaborators with the perpetrators of the Holocaust. They participated in the suppression of Jewish resistance, and they organized a consistent opposition to any escape on the part of European Jewry.
Er wilt uns führen kann Jerusalem. Wir sollen dort Goladayen. Wir wollen besser sein in Russland. Wir wollen sich befreien. Wir wollen besser sein in Russland. Wir wollen sich befreien.
And the Zionist movement did not miss a beat with the advent of Nazism in Europe. On the contrary, the local Zionist organization of Germany expressed its open support for the Nazi Party and enlisted the Nazi Party as its sponsors. And the labor Zionists would bring Eichmann to Palestine in the 1930s, Baron von Mildenstein of the SS for a period of 6 months, leading to a 12-part series in the publication of the SS called Der Angriff, which means the assault, praising Zionism, with Heydrich and Himmler overseeing the stamping of a coin with the swastika on one side and the Star of David on the other, culminating indeed in the moment when the Zionist movement of Shamir made a formal military pact with the Wehrmacht, discovered in the German embassy in Ankara at the end of the Second World War and known as the Ankara document.
Oh, you foolish little Zionists, with your utopian mentality, you'd better go down to the factory and learn the workers' reality. You'd better go down to the factory and learn the workers' reality. You want to take us to Jerusalem so we can die as a nation. We'd rather stay in the diaspora and fight for our liberation. We'd rather stay in the diaspora and work for our liberation.
Colonization of Palestine has been punctuated by periodic massacre from one end of that country to the other. It is the means through which Palestine was emptied of its population. Now, we should bear in mind that in 1947, there were now 600,000 settlers and 1.4 million Palestinian Arabs. At the time of the partitioning of Palestine over the heads of the Palestinian people in 1947, the settler population were 27% of the populace. The United Nations heard before the Select Committee on Palestine the testimony of Rabbi Fishman on behalf of the Jewish Agency. And Rabbi Fishman presented a map based upon the diaries of Theodor Herzl, page 711 of volume 2 of the Complete Diaries of Theodor Herzl, which declared that the area of Eretz Israel of the Jewish state stretched from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates. And that map, which was presented to the United Nations as to what constituted Eretz Israel, included all of Palestine, all of Transjordan, Egypt up to the Nile, including Cairo, one-third of Arabia, two-thirds of Syria, 40% of Iraq, and the southern tier of Turkey, right indeed extending up to and encompassing Kuwait. Eretz Israel, 1947, formally presented on behalf of the Jewish Agency for Palestine before the United Nations Special Committee on Inquiry on July 9, 1947.
Глупенькие сионисты, вы такие утописты, вы бы лучше ли в рабочие или в трубочисты, вы бы лучше ли в рабочие или в трубочисты.
The Koenig Report. We will use terror, assassination, intimidation, land confiscation, the cutting of all social services to rid the Galilee of its Arab populace. Chairman Heilbrun of the Committee for the Re-election of General Shlomo Lahat, the mayor of Tel Aviv. We shall kill all the Palestinians unless they are resigned to live here as slaves. And here are the words of Yuri Lubrani, David Ben-Gurion's special advisor in Arab affairs in 1960. We shall reduce the Palestinian population to a community of woodcutters and waiters. And Raphael Eitan, the chief of staff of Israel's armed forces, we declare openly, the Palestinian Arabs have no right to settle on even one centimeter of Eretz Israel. You good souls should know that the gas chambers of Adolf Hitler will be as a recreational palace. Force is all they do or ever will understand, and we shall use the ultimate force until the Palestinians come crawling to us on all fours. Eitan elaborated before the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee a formal declaration. When we have settled this land, all the Arabs will be able to do is scurry around like drugged roaches in a bottle. Well, then, how did they go about it and what did they do? Process, as I said, was one of sustained slaughter. Village after village was wiped out. The killing was intended to cause people to flee for their lives. The commander of the Haganah, Zvi Ankori, described it in detail. We oversaw cut-off genitalia, women's crushed stomachs. It was direct murder. Menachem Begin would gloat over the impact throughout Palestine of the Nazi-like operations that he commanded at Deir Yassin. A legend of terror spread amongst Arabs who were seized with panic at the mere mention of our soldiers. It was worth dozens of battalions to our forces. Palestinians throughout the country were seized with limitless panic and fled for their lives. this mass flight be developed into a maddened, uncontrollable stampede. Of the 800,000 Arabs who lived on the present territory of Israel, only 165,000 are still there. The political and economic significance of this achievement can hardly be overestimated.
You want to take us to Jerusalem so we can die as a nation. We'd rather stay in the diaspora and fight for our liberation. We'd rather stay in the diaspora and wait for our liberation.
It is a struggle that speaks to all of us, and we cannot deny to the Palestinian people that elementary right to resist, that we reserve for ourselves. Because our own oppression and the subjugation that our rulers would impose upon us is in tandem with their visiting upon the people of Palestine and the Arab East their imperial designs, of which the Zionist colonial state is but a locus operandus, the means of enforcement, the inexorable reflection of capitalism and imperialism and of a ruling class in our lives. And that is our obligation and our struggle to speak truth to power and to stand with the Palestinian people in their resistance and their struggle for survival.
That was Ralph Shulman, author of The Hidden History of Zionism. Now voices from the protest of solidarity with Palestine on the 73rd anniversary of Nakba, when over 750,000 Palestinians were expelled by massacre from
our
their homeland.
Our story is not unique. Over 530 other towns were massacred, destroyed, or left uninhabitable. Exactly 73 years ago, in this month alone, in 1948, 300,000 people had their lives uprooted. 15,000 people were killed in a series of mass atrocities. I am constantly told that my people are the oppressors, the terrorists, the invaders, that we are thieves. We must never let our stories be told through this light. Malcolm X once said, if you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people who are being oppressed and loving the people who are doing the oppressing.
Us Palestinians will not stop fighting until we reach liberation. There is a reason Israel has failed in all their attempts to silence us, divide us, and erase our existence. No matter where we are in the world, no matter how they attempt to attack us, our identity, our struggle for liberation, and the fight for the right of return will never die down. We will never forget about who we are and where we come from. If we don't return within our lifetime, the Palestinian generations after us will keep fighting until we return back home to free Palestine. We will return.
Zionism is racism. We must no longer tolerate the anti-Palestinian racist arguments and narratives that dominate the mainstream media, Hollywood, academia, the so-called liberal organizations, our college campuses, Congress, and social media. It is no longer acceptable to be progressive except on Palestine. Palestine is not the exception. My people are not the exception. The struggle for justice is still young, and we will continue to rise up. Long live the Palestinian struggle for justice. Long live the Palestinian resistance. Min al-Nahr ila al-Bahar, hanharrab Palestine.
The world is watching. Y'all keep the pressure up. Solidarity from Colombia to Palestine.
Rasha Anaya and Laura Albast are activists with the Palestinian Youth Movement. They spoke to WPFW producer and host of On the Ground, Esther Iverum.
The Nakba is ongoing. The catastrophe of 1948 is not a moment or just one event, but it's something that's spanned across time and space. And so for me personally, growing up, like I grew up listening to my grandmother's stories of fleeing to caves to hide from different like Israeli forces in the Haganah in 1948. I've heard the stories of my father when he was a kid fleeing in 1967 in the events of the Nakba, which we call the setback. And so these are stories we've all grown up with, and now we're watching those stories happen in real time. Like when we say like, oh, settlers are going to the occupied territories in 48 and they're going around and they're marking doors and they're stabbing and they're chasing people down and they're running basically pogroms against Arabs and against Palestinians. That's something that happened in 1948 and continued through to this day. There have been many massacres in Palestine at the hands of Israeli occupation forces. And right now we're witnessing another one in real time. And, you know, the power of the Instagram lives and of the Facebook lives is, despite the media blackout, we're watching our own people record these instances and share them with us and with the world. And so it's like one of those things of, what would I do like in a certain situation? And we're facing that right now. And it's so important for us to stand up, because there's really nowhere to hide from it. It's in our faces and we have to act.
What you said is so important. And I want you to add more, Rasha and Laura, about the importance of being able to get out your own story and how social media has allowed this story to be told from the moment that, you know, the video hit about the Israeli settler, you know, telling a woman, you know, if I don't steal your house, someone else will, right? To the images, horrific images at Al-Aqsa going out. How has the movement been benefited or, on the other hand, you know, hindered by social media?
You know, there are pros and cons to this, right? Now more than ever, anyone with an internet connection and access to social media can go and see exactly with their own eyes what is happening. People are able to reach out to Palestinians in the diaspora from Palestine to tell them, hey, we need you to shed light on this. This is what's happening. Media isn't covering this. Why isn't media covering this? On the one hand, Israel does prevent a lot of international press from entering certain areas where they are actively assaulting Palestinians. On the other hand, American media actively participates in the censorship of the Palestinian narrative by concealing the truth and by echoing Israeli talking points and narrative. The New York Times alone, Patrick Kingsley, he's very new heading the New York Times Bureau in Jerusalem. He says he wants to do fair reporting. Last week, he called the Israeli settlers landlords of the properties where the Palestinians are going to be expelled. He also, when he reported about the HRW, the human rights report that accused Israel of crimes of apartheid, his entire report was basically like a press release from the Israeli government. He just found ways to discredit that press release. At the same time, when it comes to social media, Facebook has been censoring a lot of people. This morning alone, they disabled a group that had more than 60,000 Palestinian and Arab users in it who are sharing information about what's happening in Jerusalem and trying to get help. So we have good things happening, we have bad things happening. We are able to see with our own eyes the direct attack, the direct assault, the apartheid, how Israel is an apartheid state. We are seeing that with our own eyes, but at the same time, Facebook and Instagram are always following us wherever we post, whatever we do, and they're trying to censor everything we put out. But they will not succeed. I'm telling you this. They will not succeed because the world now sees Israel for its true colors.
I think a lot of Palestinian students, we face this. A lot of students that work for Palestinian liberation and in the Palestinian struggle face this. And there's not really that many safe spaces, honestly, where we can talk about it without fear of being pinned into being called an anti-Semite. And this is the project of the Zionist Hasbara propaganda machine, where they even have an entire ministry that does this, where they claim that to critique Zionism is to critique Judaism, is to be an anti-Semite, anti-Zionism as anti-Semitic. And this falls from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, I think it is, or association, the IHRA definition that a lot of government institutions are trying to implement, which then would make law that critiquing Zionism makes you anti-Semitic. Of course, we completely reject that because Zionism is not about Judaism. Zionism is about dispossessing Palestinians and committing ethnic cleansing on Palestine and removing us from our homes. That's the actual reality of what it is. To critique Zionism is to defend Palestinian life and to defend our struggle and to call for the liberation of our homelands. What happens on campuses specifically is they go after students that speak up. And this is not something new. This has been going on for a really long time, where to stand up for Palestine is to be called a terrorist. And this has led to many damaging things to the movements, because a lot of people get really scared and they get scared into silence. It's not just the government that's doing that, and that's really important. Really, a lot of it are these Zionist think tanks or just weird organizations that do that. There's like entire law centers that are like focused on going after like undergraduate students, you know, remove them from getting an education, having quote unquote successful careers, whatever that means to you. And this is something I personally have experienced for my activism, where I've been targeted. Canary Mission is an entire website that was established in 2015 by the David Horowitz campaign. And what they do is they go to campuses, they find students that speak about Palestine, they paint them as terrorists, they call Students for Justice for Palestine a terrorist organization, they try to make all of these absurd connections, and then blacklist you. And so, like, for people like me who are aspiring academics, you know, that hurts your career. That has a tangible material effect on Palestinians in the U.S. when you search a person's name and what you see is page after page after page of calling them like these things and playing off Islamophobic tropes, playing off of anti-Arab racism, playing off of anti-Palestinian racism. And so this is something that we see a lot. What I do want to say for all of any listeners who have faced this or other Palestinians is the goal of these campaigns is to scare us into silence. And so the response for us must be to not be silent. No matter how many pages they have about you, no matter if it's a small publication, small Zionist publication in your local media, or if it's all the way to the Times of Israel, what they're trying to do there is they're trying to silence Palestinians and silence them so that they can continue our ethnic cleansing. Because our role in the United States is to join together and build power and to speak out and to bring our community into a political process in which we can liberate our people and work with our people both in all of the, like, globally who have been dispersed. And so really it's so, so critical for us to continue to speak out and to continue to do that. So not to fall victim to these campaigns.
We heard from Rasha Anaya and Laura Albest with the Palestinian Youth Movement. We thank WPFW's on-the-ground host and producer, Esther Iverum.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred.
This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. In 2020, the British Labour Party, alleging anti-Semitism, suspended Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Tony Greenstein, himself a victim of expulsion from the party, talks to Pacifica about the connection between Zionism and Nazi German government officials. Zionist lobby pressure resulted in him being expelled from the party.
As regards the Labour Party in Britain, as you will know, in 2015, the first ever left-wing leader, certainly since the first leader, Keir Hardie, was elected to the leadership, a guy called Jeremy Corbyn, who'd been fairly outspoken in support of the Palestinians. And you immediately got a counter-reaction, as one could expect, from the right. But Corbyn, in many ways, proved very popular. He increased Labour's vote at the 2017 election. And it was clear to the right after that, if not before it, that attacking Corbyn on basic issues of austerity was not proving very popular. So the right, I think, fell in line behind the anti-Semitism allegations, which in essence boiled down to, if you support the Palestinians, if you oppose Zionism, then you're an anti-Semite. And I became the first Jewish victim of the anti-Semitism witch hunt, and I was expelled in 2018. But today, there are dozens of Jewish people who were suspended or expelled by Keir Starmer, who are Jewish on the grounds that they're anti-Semites, in essence. Say anything about Israel today in the Labour Party, and you will get witch hunted by people who have no concern for anti-racism when it comes to Black Lives Matter, racism against Black people, and so on the contrary.
As you said, Trump is a big supporter of Israel, was a big supporter, a Zionist, his family, Kushner. And there's a history of Zionists working with right-wingers, in fact, supporting Nazis. What's the history of Zionism and support for right-wing and even Nazis?
Well, it's a long history, isn't it? I mean, Zionism grew about. I mean, the Zionism was a reaction to anti-Semitism in the late 19th century. I mean, the first Zionist organization, the Lovers of Zion, was created in 1881 as a result of the Odessa pogroms. I mean, a wave of pogroms after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. And the guy who formed it, Leo Pinsker, spoke about it. He said in his book, Auto Emancipation, he wrote that Judeophobia, because he was a doctor and he described it in medical terms, he said Judeophobia is a mental disease, and as such it is hereditary, because in those days mental illness was thought to be hereditary. Having been inherited for 2,000 years, it is incurable. Well, if you believe that a disease is incurable, what's the point of treating it? The only way you treat it is with palliatives to ease the suffering of the patient, but you can't cure the disease. And that was the view of Zionism towards non-Jews. They were inherently anti-Semitic. And why? Because Jews were strangers in other people's lands. I mean, A.B. Yehoshua, who's a famous Zionist novelist and poet, talked about Jews having abused their rights as guests in other people's hotels. They use their country as like, I mean, Zionism stems from the basis that Jews belong in Israel. That's their natural home. So in that sense, they agreed with the anti-Semites that the Jews did not belong. So it's no wonder that when the Nazis came to power, almost the first thing the Zionist Federation did was to jot off a letter to Hitler, 21st of June, 1933, proposing that as racial Jews, they were in agreement. They too believed on the foundations of race, a new state would be established and the Jews will know their place as a national minority. The Zionists had no objection to the Nuremberg laws, which removed citizenship from Jews, because as far as they were concerned, Jews had no right to citizenship. Early in the 1920s, I mean, Kurt Blumenfeld, who was then the president of the German Zionist Federation, told Walter Rathenau, the German foreign minister, who was Jewish, that he had no right to occupy a high political position in the German state because he was Jewish. You know, which was exactly what the anti-Semites were saying. Rathenau was assassinated, as it happens, I think 1922. But the attitude of Zionists has always been that Jews don't really belong. So there was a symmetry, an ideological symmetry. Of course, most Zionists don't understand it. But when Netanyahu came to France after the Charlie Hebdo massacres, you remember four Jews were killed in the Hypercache supermarket in Paris. Netanyahu spoke to a crowded synagogue and he told them that you don't belong here. Your natural, your rightful home is in Israel. I mean, the Zionist message has been very consistent throughout the 30s. I mean, the Nazis saw the Zionists as the good Jews. I mean, that's as simple as it is.
The question is, though, is politically, if the Democrats and like the British Labour Party have a position of supporting Israel, how do you see that changing politically within these the Labour Party or the Democratic Party? Because the Democratic Party, Biden and Kamala Harris, are both consider themselves Zionist, hardcore Zionists. They support Zionism.
I think they have a real problem now. I think there's been a sea shift in public opinion about Israel. Support for Israel is an establishment narrative. It's not a popular narrative. And I think that's important. And also Israel is moving in a way politically to the far right in a way that didn't happen 20 years ago. We don't have the Israeli Labour Party. We don't even have the moderate Likud of say, Moshe Aaron's was we would have thought of as on the far right, but compared to the creatures you have today, you know, Bezalel Smotrich, who openly says that, well, his wife doesn't want to share a maternity ward with an Arab woman because she's bringing into the world someone who's going to kill his his child if he gets half the chance. You know, I mean, these are vile. I mean, these are Judeo-Nazis. I mean, they're not, you know, let's call them by what they are. I mean, or Itamar Gevir, whose alliance with Smotrich's party, Netanyahu acted as the midwife to that in order no far-right votes were lost. I mean, so he could well be part of the governing coalition. I mean, this was, you know, I mean, in 1988, Meir Kahan was ostracized and vilified in the Knesset. Today, Itamar Gevir is seen as a normal, respectable member of the Knesset. So, I mean, things have changed. Also in Israel, racism is to the fore. You have mobs chanting death to the Arabs. I mean, that's their favorite chant. So you can't hide these things indefinitely. People do become aware of it. And so you're getting, I think, in America, just as in Britain, a growing coalescence of the right and the far right with Israel. And we saw that with the invasion of Capitol Hill, where you had neo-Nazis and their flags. 6 million wasn't enough, side by side with the Israeli flag. I mean, you know, I mean, ideology is coming into line with material circumstances, as Marx would have said.
That was Tony Greenstein, former member of the British Labour Party. Pacifica affiliate KKFI Kansas City, on their show Understanding Israel and Palestine, spoke with Dima Khalidi, director of Palestine Legal, about attacks on the free speech of Palestinians and critics of Israel.
Since 2014, we've had 30 states enact, in one way or another, legislation that punishes boycotts for Palestinian rights and other kinds of advocacy for Palestinian rights. 30 states. And in many of these cases, legislatures are pretty unanimous in passing legislation that is undermining all of our constitutional rights. If we undermine the right to boycott for Palestinian rights, what will stop undermining all of our right to boycott on any justice issue? This is a protest tactic to bring our collective power to bear to make social and economic change that is being attacked. So this is a really troubling development. And we're also seeing legislation now to impose, to codify a really distorted definition of anti-Semitism that for the most part is perfectly in line with traditional definitions of anti-Semitism, but it veers off in giving examples of anti-Semitism related to Israel. And in doing that, it basically encompasses any criticism of Israel that you could imagine by saying, for example, that calling Israel a racist endeavor is equal to anti-Semitism, or double standards against Israel equals anti-Semitism. So this definition is also being used in many of the cases that we see to justify the censorship and the punishment of people who are speaking out for Palestinian rights in a very troubling way. So this kind of state-level repression is a major development that we've seen. And it also includes the FBI knocking on activist doors, sometimes in reaction to complaints, but often investigating people's posts about freedom for Palestinians. So this escalation is also in line with what we're seeing across the board against justice movements, against the movement for Black Lives, against indigenous resistance to pipelines and the exploitation of their land and resources, against campus movements in general, against environmental movements. There's legislation across the board that is undermining all of our constitutional rights to engage in dissent and to protest and to use different tactics in registering our dissent.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the backlash to the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement. I'm wondering how these laws come about, because I wouldn't think most legislators have Israel as the foremost issue on their mind. How do these laws develop, and what can Palestine Legal do to reverse or question these laws?
It's a good question. How are our state legislatures convinced to pass these laws that are basically shielding a foreign government from criticism, from a protest movement, and in the process undermining our own constitutional rights? What we see is that there are a number of Israel lobby groups that are consistently lobbying state legislatures, as well as the US Congress, to pass these kinds of laws. And they've been aided by groups like ALEC, which is a far right, the name is escaping my mind, but the Legislative Exchange Commission, that basically creates copy and paste legislation and passes it around to state legislators. So they have been pushing the anti-boycott legislation. They are also behind the anti-Semitism type of legislation that I mentioned. And then you have groups that are Christian Zionist groups as well, far-right Christian evangelical groups that are extremely pro-Israel, anti-Palestinian, that are also trying to push this kind of legislation. The other thing that we've seen is that Israeli government officials themselves are calling on our elected officials to pass this kind of legislation. Netanyahu himself called on the governor of Kentucky, I believe, asking him to issue an executive order with the same kind of legislation. And he said, yes, of course, I would love to do that. So imagine foreign leaders asking our elected officials to shield their country from criticism of its fundamental human rights violations. This is indisputable, the kind of war crimes and human rights violations Israel engages in on a daily basis. And this kind of legislation is really designed to scare people into silence so that we don't talk about it, we don't expose these things, we don't resist the oppression of Palestinians.
Over the summer, some 120 pro-Israel organizations sent a letter to Facebook urging it to label criticism of Israel as hate speech on the basis of a broad, controversial definition of anti-Semitism, which you've discussed earlier. What is the standard Facebook has adopted, and what effect has that had on what people may say on Facebook as regards Israel and Palestine?
As I think we all are realizing more and more, the fact is that Facebook standards are not transparent. They are not well known to any of us. And we also know that Facebook has been pressured heavily by Israel and Israel advocates to censor speech related to Palestinian rights. And we see that day to day. People come to us every day saying, my Facebook account was shut down because I posted something about some event or shared something. Or often we have to deal with these things case by case. But this really requires some deep interrogation of the role of these huge tech companies that, especially today with the pandemic, are controlling our public squares, places where people gather and engage. And this is also a recent issue with Zoom canceling an open classroom event at a public university. Zoom is now operating basically as a stand-in for universities, where the First Amendment applies, where it's supposed to be the marketplace of ideas. And Zoom canceled a classroom event about gender and narratives around resistance that was featuring Leila Khaled, as well as Black and South African former revolutionaries, to discuss this topic in an academic setting. This is another, especially now, another front that we have to really take seriously and try to put the same standards on these companies as are on public institutions, because they are in effect playing that role often.
That was Dima Khalidi speaking to Margot Patterson of Pacifica Radio Affiliate KKFI in Kansas City.
I think it's a trend, a fascist statement. Disgustingly, I spit on the pavement. It's basic. Y'all know I bang for my flag. My bandana ain't no rag. The keffiyeh ain't no scarf. It's a part of the movement. The symbolism is resistance. No coincidence that you can see the RBG in it. Cable neath the bandana. Ain't it beautiful? I say it in Spanish. It's solidarity. The feelings is mutual. Meanwhile, hi, that's M1 in Arabic. I'm pro-Falastini, does that make me a terrorist? You can catch me in Gaza, in Haifa or Ramallah, but I'm still just Mutulu Olubala. So when I rep with Shaja, we rhyme with our middle fingers up to the Zionists, cause we don't give a it's justice. So tie that thing around your head and ride. Wave it in the air and let me know what side you want. Uhuru, yeah. The keffiyeh is Arab. Yeah, it's M1. Solidarity, feel me, Shaja. Do it. From the ghetto to Gaza.
This is Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Professor Rabab Abdulhadi is the chair of the San Francisco State University Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diasporas Program. She discusses how her department has been attacked by Zionists who have accused her and her students of being terrorists. She also reports on Zoom, Facebook, and YouTube shutting down her webinars.
My students and I were labeled, they claimed, the Amcha Initiative, which is a right-wing pro-Israel Zionist group in California, claimed that we are glorifying the murder of Jews, which was completely baseless. That was in 2013. David Horowitz, so-called Freedom Center and the Canary Mission, that called me Jew hater and called me a terrorist and called and put up the names of my students on posters all over the university, by likened us to Nazis, likened us to terrorism and so on. They weren't only one time. The first time it was in October 2014, but then they again and again and again and again. And the university claims that they don't take them down because this is they are supporting freedom of speech. And of course, this is weaponizing right-wing racist speech. David Horowitz is labeled by the Southern Poverty Law Center as one of the leading Islamophobes. I was also received several like really offensive and really racist emails, Islamophobic, misogynist, but also I also received the veiled death threats from somebody claiming to be a New York City retired detective who says, I'm not going to call violence, but watch out if you cross the street, watch out if you have an argument, watch out. Why I received another letter, it was sent to the president's office, and after 3 weeks the university decided that they should let me know. And they held it off because they claimed that nobody wants to hear bad news. I was sued along with the university. By the way, all the groups that I'm talking about, Campus Watch, David Horowitz Freedom Center, the Canary Mission, Amcha Initiative, Stand With Us, the Lawfare Project, they received funding from the Jewish Federation of San Francisco, which is bigger than the Jewish Community Relations Council. This is something that was proven by a reporter from The Forward, which is one of the main Jewish magazine, and he basically did all this investigative research and looked at the tax forms that these foundations are submitting.
Thank you. And Rabab, you're not the only professor academic who's been targeted. You think there's a systemic targeting of Palestinian professors and professors who are critical of the policies of Israel?
Yes, I definitely believe that this is, as I have argued, this is not random, this is not isolated, this is not accidental. There is a strong targeting by the Israel lobby groups because they have failed to cover up for Israeli colonialism, racism and apartheid. And what they are trying to do is to actually lash out stronger and more in order to silence our voices in the academy and elsewhere who are speaking up. So I'm definitely not the first targeted now. Professor Sean Malloy has also been targeted, our colleague Tomomi Kinakawa. Also there have been many others. Professor Stephen Salaita actually was fired after he was hired because he criticized Israeli bombing of Gaza in 2014. So this has continued again and again. And I believe part of the problem for the Zionists is that they're really trying to silence the voices, to speak up and be critical, and speak up for holding Israel accountable like any other country. There is no more or no less. Nobody is exceptionalizing Israel or anything like that. I should also say, by the way, that even by the time that the South African movement has been able to undo political apartheid in 1994 when Nelson Mandela was elected president, not completely, no structural issue and so on. When they were able to do that, there were still many corporations and many government policy, and they were still in bed with South Africa. I mean, the United States was actually talking about something called constructive engagement, which people forget about that because it's been a while ago. But it's also colonial powers and oppressive powers continue again and again and again. And this is the point of our webinar in 2020, our webinar in 2021, the webinar that Professor Malloy invited me about the question of the narratives. The question is, how do you tell history, which history, which goes back to the whole question of how do you even teach about critical ethnic studies, which stories do you tell? So what the Zionists are trying to do, and with them, along with them, as the white supremacists, along with them, the neoliberal university, and I think it's really, really important to also emphasize that, you alluded to that when you spoke about the University of California board and so on. It has to do with the whole question about the impact of capitalism, of finance, of money, along with the whole question of a prevailing, very colonialist, orientalist, Islamophobic mindset that also does not really deviate very far from the racist discourse that actually says that whenever people who are marginalized are able to teach about lived experiences, that's some kind of a gift that colonial powers or oppressive powers in power are actually giving us. And we say this is not a gift. This is what we really need to be teaching. What the Zionists are trying to do is they're trying to block the possibility for us to teach, to make this part of the legitimate academic curriculum. And this is why the Zoom silenced us. This is why they vetoed the content of our classroom. And this is why our neoliberal administrations, both at SFSU, at UC Merced, actually went along with it and proposed alternative programming to make it appear as if our program is actually illegitimate, to delegitimize the critical anti-colonial notions that we were trying to do.
That was Professor Rabab Abdulhadi, Chair of the San Francisco State University Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diasporas Program. Abby Martin, journalist and producer of the Empire Files, spoke to Pacifica KPFK producer Polina Vasiliev.
Abby Martin, you and Mike Breisner recently released Gaza Fights for Freedom, a film that's more important than ever today. Tell us about that.
Yes, I made a feature-length documentary called Gaza Fights for Freedom. It documents the harrowing war crimes throughout the Great March of Return. This was made in 2019, and we just released it for free for everyone to check out on YouTube, on our Empire Files YouTube channel. But YouTube, of course, is throttling it. It's censoring search results, so you have to go directly to the Empire Files YouTube channel to check it out. It basically just depicts the actual reality of the Great March of Return, because as we know, the corporate media has an outlandish, one-sided depiction of this conflict. They literally flip reality upside down and just say that the Israelis are the victims here, when really they are the oppressors, they are the colonizers, and they are committing just heinous war crime after war crime. And so this documentary really just depicts the heroic struggle of the Palestinians, of resistance, I mean, against this ongoing genocidal apartheid state. It's an incredible film. I recommend everyone to check it out. It was made by Palestinians living within the Gaza Strip that are, of course, confined in this small area and are forbidden to leave by the State of Israel. It's a real, really eye-opening film I recommend for anyone who doesn't really know that much about the conflict. And even if you do, I mean, it's a tool for the movement to show your friends and family and really just clear-cut evidence of war crimes, the direct sniper targeting of children, medics, journalists, and disabled people, which of course are all violations of the Geneva Convention.
Now talk about the censorship.
Yeah, so YouTube has censored almost all of our Palestine content, either made it age-restricted or throttled it completely. So it's not available in people's subscriptions. You actually can't find it. If you search for the titles themselves, you have to actually go to the videos themselves on our playlist and open them. Beyond that, of course, we know that many, many affiliates with the Israeli government work on behalf of Facebook, of course, working in concert with the U.S. Empire and all of the big tech overlords that curate our reality. They basically answer to the Israeli state as well as the U.S. and all of its proxies. So you are not going to get the truth about this issue anywhere on corporate media. It's increasingly getting censored on social media platforms. And so you really have to go to the source directly, Palestinian journalists, and start amplifying their voices, because the censorship is rampant and it's just getting worse.
Abby, I heard you sued the state of Georgia over a First Amendment issue that had to do with the Zionist lobby. What happened?
A lot of Americans may be surprised to learn that in 30 states, so over half of the states in the United States, there are laws on the book that mandate independent contractors. So for example, if you work construction, if you're a substitute teacher, or if you, like me, were simply going to give a keynote address at a university. In my case, I was going to Georgia Southern to give a keynote address about media literacy. And yeah, I mean, I was slated to give a keynote address at this university for a conference that had nothing to do with Palestine, you know? And I was given this contract that basically was a loyalty pledge. That's essentially what they are. They are loyalty pledges to Israel. And of course, I said, I cannot sign this. This is outrageous. How is this happening? And so I decided to actually sue the state of Georgia, because that's the only way these bills will be knocked down. They have been passed very flagrantly in violation of the Constitution, and they need to be challenged legally in order to be knocked down. They already have been knocked down in several states, Texas, Arkansas, Wisconsin, I think, just also held a court case that ruled in favor of the plaintiff. And so we're hoping that in the case of Georgia, that this is struck down, because it is just an outrageous violation of our liberties. I mean, the fact that this is happening in so many states across the country really just shows you the power of the Israeli lobby. Days after I filed my lawsuit, Netanyahu's Ministry of Strategic Affairs actually bragged on Twitter. They said, whoever boycotts us will be boycotted. In recent years, we've promoted laws in most U.S. states which determine that strong action is to be taken against whoever tries to boycott Israel. So you have a foreign nation threatening economic consequences against our constitutional rights, and forcing people to pick between your First Amendment or your ability to work. You know, boycotts are fundamentally protected liberty. This was ruled by the Supreme Court back during the civil rights era, the Montgomery bus boycotts. This was an essential tool, a nonviolent, peaceful action that brought down apartheid in South Africa. This is a necessity. We have the right to boycott things that we don't want. And let me ask your audience this. Just imagine if you were given a contract that said you can never boycott the country of Russia. Right? And then you had Putin bragging on Twitter that he actually forced all these states to pass this law. I mean, can you imagine the uproar of corporate media in that case? So it is really cartoonish when you actually replace Israel with literally any other entity and just see how just beyond the pale this really is, and how essential it is that we challenge these laws and spread the word, because this is really a campaign of public consciousness. We need to tell people what is going on, because Israel's scared of BDS, and we can see their war crimes right now ongoing against the Gaza Strip, the war crimes in Sheikh Jarrah, and we need to stand in solidarity with Palestinian activists, and that means the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And they are scared of it because they know that international pressure being mounted is what is going to bring down apartheid.
Abby Martin, host of Empire Files, director of Gaza Fights for Freedom, a feature documentary now available on YouTube for free. That is, if it hasn't been censored. For Pacifica, I'm Polina Vasiliev.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank Pacifica's five sister stations and its 200-plus radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer and Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You heard music by Shadia Mansour, Dead Prez, Michael Hart, Daniel Kahn, and Soy Korolenko. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.